3:07. Welcome back to Sabah al Muslim on Radio Islam International. Joining us now on the line, we have Aman Muhammad. He's the CEO of FNB Islamic Banking. We're talking about the growth in the demand for Islamic finance in South Africa, where even non-Muslims are increasingly turning to Islamic finance options. Aman, jazakumullah for your time. Much appreciated. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh, and welcome.
Wa alaikum salam, and my absolute pleasure to be on your show.
Just give us a brief history of Islamic finance in the South African context.
Interesting to note, you know, when we look at our really rich history of Islam in the country, you know, it spans back nearly 360 years.
Mm.
And also, you know, the whole link with the Muslims involved in politics, being South Africa, specifically Cape Town and Robben Island, being a political colony for Muslims that came from the Far East, like Indonesia and those places. Since those days, Muslims have shaped and formed political thought and economic thought in South Africa. So it wouldn't be surprising, even though we number only 2%, that at some point in time, there'd be a demand for a more formalized system of Islamic economics in the country. And alhamdulillah, you know, just in the last few years, we've seen it actually become formal. So while it's been operating probably for the last 30 years under the guise of certain different asset managers and eventually into a standalone bank, it was formally legislated through changes through the National Tax Act, where Islamic structures like Ijara, Murabaha, Mudaraba formally took form and full recognition in the South African legislation. And for us, you know, that is phenomenal, because all of that eventually led to the South African government, being a non-Muslim government, issuing Sukuk, which was listed in Luxembourg. So giving us credibility in sub-Saharan Africa and possibly all of Africa as well, as one of the first non-Muslim countries in the world to issue an Islamic instrument. And as you pointed out, non-Muslim people taking interest. The Sukuk was a prime example where we used an Islamic instrument to benefit all of South Africa, which is largely a non-Muslim country. So I think this is where the interest and appreciation for the structures that we use have come to play.
Do non-Muslims indicate as to why they opt for Islamic finance or Islamic instruments, as you put it?
So sometimes the reasons are actually quite simple. Recently, we financed a motor vehicle for a divorced mum of two. And she noted that in the uncertain times that we're actually dealing with, and how appropriate with this afternoon the announcement on whether the prime interest rate will be increasing or not, she said she doesn't understand how the fluctuations of the interest rate works, because she understands that every time it goes up, she has to pay more. And the Islamic structure, because of one of the tenets being transparency in contract, we actually price you up front and we do a fixed contract. So for a simple reason, that it allows this particular individual to budget more effectively, was her choice for Islamic finance. In other cases, you have a guy who's on the verge of retiring. He's about to get a lump sum payout from his employer, and he calls up and says, listen, I'd like to, you know, invest my money with an Islamic financial institution. And we say, you know, because you can hear from the voice or whatever, you can assess it's non-Muslim, so you explain that it is an Islamic product.
Mm.
And the guy says, look, I fully understand, and I'm actually quite devout in whatever faith I'm in. But the one thing that I do trust is that I know Muslims do not get involved in sin industries, and I do also know that Muslims do not get involved in interest. So therefore, my choice to place funds with Islamic finance is for the following reason. So what we've seen is there is an appreciation for the principles and values-based approach, which is definitely an attractant to non-Muslim people to this type of alternative investment.
How is Islamic banking growing in South Africa if we look at the last, say, 10 to 15 years? What's the growth been like?
Yeah, so if you look at, firstly, the points that I raised, the fact that the South African National Treasury has actually taken Islamic financial structures so seriously that they've introduced them into the national tax legislation. So for all the youngsters that are studying to become chartered accountants and those that are studying taxation, these are rules that they actually will learn in their curriculum. So one, at a governmental level, people are beginning to understand that Islamic finance and Islamic structures are here to stay. Secondly, from us, that actually operate in the Islamic financial services industry, we have seen growth. And interesting to note, whether it's banking or asset management, in fact, for a population of just 2%, we see more than 25 listed funds on the JSE in terms of investment. When you look at the Islamic banks, even though, you know, a lot of information is not easily available because of the structures in the way in which some banks operate, you find that growth has been phenomenal. I mean, if I quote the bank that I come from, FNB Islamic, between our last financial year end, which was June, through to December, we've seen at least 100% growth in our deposit base. So apart from the non-Muslims, the Muslims of South Africa are beginning to understand the need to opt for an alternate banking form that negates riba.
Funny, Aman, do you still get the skeptics? Do you still get those who say, well, you know, what's the difference? Because Islamic banks are still charging very similar rates to those of conventional banks. In the case of FNB or EBSA, for that matter, you're a division of a broader conventional bank, so it's going into the same pot at the end of the day. Do you get those skeptics, and how do you respond to them?
So, Maulana, you're 100% correct. The skeptic the response is actually quite straightforward. So one, given, and I keep on going back to the fact that legislation now makes it a lot easier to operate in the macro environment. So that means what it allows us to do, it allows us to actually manage Muslim funds a lot more prudently. And one of the things that we certainly do at our bank is the pot that you talk of, we like to refer to as a treasury. Mm. We've actually been able to successfully ring fence the Islamic treasury. So Islamic funds that, in very simply put, Islamic funds that come into the bank are actually used to fund Islamic assets. And alhamdulillah, we're at a point, and I'm quite sure I speak for many of the other Islamic banks as well, where we're at a point where all of our Islamic funds, we can satisfy all of the guys looking for Islamic finance, and we actually land up in a situation where we have excess funds. And if Islamic banking wasn't called Islamic banking, we probably would call it enterprise banking, because in order for me to generate a profit to distribute back to my depositors, we've actually got involved in some interesting commodity and equity structures where we're able to buy and sell commodities like grains. And the profit that we make on those are actually comparable or in some cases even better than the money market rates that conventional banks are making. So we're able to share that with our customer. And the last point was the fact that we're part of a bigger commercial bank. True, but the ring fence on our treasury actually allows us to separate ourselves from the main core bank activity.
Finally, Aman, on a totally unrelated issue, this morning we're having a discussion about working hours. There was this article in the Business Day earlier this week that says internationally the trend is that people should work shorter hours or lesser hours, rather, and try and be more productive in those hours. And some experts are saying that once this generation of bosses go into retirement, the next generation will move towards a three-day weekend and a shorter working week. What's your experience in the field that you are in? Do you think we need to move that route, you know, fewer working hours but more productive, create more of a balance in a person's life?
Now, Maulana, interestingly you bring that up because I've got a wife who's a business person, and she owns a couple of stores. And, you know, she often accuses me that you sit on a soft chair in an air-conditioned office while we're working in the retail front lines. And I often say to her that, you know, when you close your shop at 5 o'clock, your worries are finished at that point, whereas with us in the banking world, we don't technically have a closing time because if fraud is going to occur, it's going to happen at any time in the day. But anyway, that's just on the humorous side. But coming back to your point, I for a long time have been struggling with the concept of work-life balance. And I find that if you're comfortable that whatever your responsibilities are to your employer have been satisfied, so whatever work you've been given is done, then I think it gives you a better peace of mind. I used to have a boss that he used to walk around the office at about 7 o'clock in the evening. And he used to actually get annoyed when he saw people sitting around the office because he'd tell them that, listen, you come to work from 8 to 5. If you can't get your work done between those hours, then I'm actually concerned that you're sitting here. It doesn't actually interest me. And for me, that's always been the point, is that I find that, you know, people are often in the office, the bums are on the seats, but the mind is not on the work at hand. So I think if the employee can be more concentrated on what he's doing, he actually can achieve that better work-life balance by completing the tasks that are being given to them in that time. Now, I know that is a broad generalization, But if you really count out all the smoke breaks and the coffee breaks and the lunch breaks and all of those things, it actually is possible that when you for the time that you've been paid to devote it to your employer, irrespective of what field you're in, and you can achieve that. And at the end of the day, I think all of us are striving, you know, to move up the corporate ladder or to make our businesses better. So for me, you know, that improvement in productivity will lead to better working hours. So inshallah, you know, if one can actually achieve that and find that balance, then I think you'll be successful in work and in life.
Hopefully. Aman, jazakallah for your time. Much appreciated.
My pleasure.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. That was Aman Muhammad, CEO of FNB Islamic Finance. We're talking this morning about the growth of Islamic finance and why non-Muslims are increasingly turning to Islamic finance products. Two reasons he gave there. Number one is there's less ambiguity. You can budget better. The premiums don't go up every time the interest rate goes up or the repayments. And the second is that many of them subscribe to other faiths and they don't want their money invested in avenues that they are not comfortable with. Our SMQ for this morning, how many formal hours do you work a day? And when do you feel that you are most productive? Do you agree that we should have fewer working hours but more productive working hours? Brother Kasim on email says, my job role is such that I can work from home at times. It is more productive given that you save travel time. This can give you about 2 extra productive hours. Using online meetings is also an option as this saves on travel time to and from meetings. It is also a good idea to schedule face-to-face meetings in off-peak traffic times. For me, the most productive time is early morning. And there's no doubt early morning is the most productive time. Brother Ghulam Kohli on a lighter note says, actual days work during a year is 365. Then you take away 13 public holidays, 2 Eids, 52 Saturdays, 52 Sundays, 12 sick days, 18 leave days, 12 excuse days. That comes to 204 work days. And if you times that by 6 hours of productive time, it comes to about 1,224 hours. If you divide that by 24, it comes to 51 days of full work. And if you divide that by 30 days, it's 1.7 months of productive work in a year. So let's work for 1 month, 21 days, and then take the rest of the year off.